$108 billion. That's the amount President Bush wants Congress to authorize to continue the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Should Congress write a check of that size? And if so, should they send it without any strings attached? Senator McCain's health care plan, will it hurt more than it helps? He's giving speeches around the country this week, but today we'll give you the information you need to evaluate what he says. What group is poised to decide the election in November? Unmarried women. That's right, you heard me. My people might be running the show. Why are unmarried women so important, and what do they care about? I'm Melody Barnes, and join me to discuss those issues and more on the Progressive Beat, broadcast from the Center for American Progress Action Fund. Welcome to the Roundtable. Today's guests are experts in the Middle East, but have opposing views regarding our country's strategy in Iraq. I'd like to welcome Brian Katulis, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund, and Michael O'Hanlon, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute. Welcome, Michael and Brian.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Brian, in May 2003, President Bush stood on the USS Abraham Lincoln and declared mission accomplished. We're coming up on that five-year anniversary. But how close are we to the administration's original goal of a unified, independent, and stable Iraq that's an ally in the war against terrorism?
I'm afraid that we're not much closer, and I'm deeply concerned about the unified and independent part of that. We're a bit more stable in Iraq. The levels of violence have declined, and I think that's a good thing. I think there are real challenges with unity in Iraq. And most importantly, I'm concerned about the independence, because I fear that the current strategy over the last few years has fostered this dangerous and dysfunctional culture of dependency among multiple Iraqi actors. And I want to stress multiple, because I really worry we're moving away from the unified and the independent portions of that strategy.
Mike, I'd like to ask you to respond to the same question and think about it in the context of a question that General Petraeus posed for us in 2003. How does this end? How do we come to conclusion in Iraq?
Yeah, it's a great question, and Brian's made some excellent points. I feared a year ago, by the way, that the only hope for us getting out with any kind of passable outcome was some kind of a soft partition, Bosnia style, because I didn't see the unified part working either, and I'm still worried that it may not. But I become a bit more hopeful that the model of a unified central government may work, provided, of course, that there is a reasonable sharing of powers with the provinces, and that big issues that haven't yet been addressed, like the return of refugees and the status of the city of Kirkuk up north, can somehow be addressed. There's been a fair amount of political progress in Iraq, but it's sort of on the easier issues, and those kinds of big questions remain. So I share a lot of Brian's concerns about the future of Iraq, even if the last year has made me quite a bit more hopeful than I was before.
Well, Mike, to pick up on one of your points, you said that you're a bit more hopeful. What's making you more hopeful today?
Well, you got to start with the basics just to get them on the table. The 75% reduction in violence, more or less. Now, depending on the statistical source and which category you're looking at, it may be a bit less than that, but it's still dramatic. And the civilian population in Iraq is much closer to having some semblance of a normal life than they were a year ago. I want to underscore they don't have a normal life now. Iraq is still the most violent country in the region. It's still way too violent, much more dangerous than it was even in the latter years under Saddam Hussein. So this is by no means meant to be a positive overall assessment of what we've accomplished over 5 years. But what we've accomplished over 1 year has been rather remarkable. And now we're starting to see some progress among Iraqis on the political front, things like sharing budget resources with the provinces, passing some of these laws like their pension law and their amnesty law and their provincial powers law. There are some other laws that have been passed, but it's not clear if they're going to do more harm than good, like the debathification reform. Nonetheless, there is some progress.
Well, Mike, hold up for a second there. Brian, I want to ask you to jump in. Do you share hope based on the political process that Mike is describing, some of the advances that he's describing in terms of the legislation that's been passed and the reduction in violence? And do you see the reduction in violence in the same way?
Well, I'm deeply concerned that what we've seen in the surge and much of the success of the surge is the result of massive displacements and a sectarian cleansing campaign that happened in 2006 and continued through 2007. And I'm also concerned that though there are some signs of hope on the political reform and political process front, that much of what Mike has talked about is on the margins, that the core issues, the key issues of sharing power, that the Constitutional Review Committee was charged to look at, the Iraqi Parliament's Constitutional Review Committee. Those issues, Iraqis have kicked the can down the road, and I'm deeply concerned that we're going to end up with an Iraq that is much more divided than it was even before this surge, in part because of the strategies that we've implemented. I think pragmatic, tactical measures, recognizing that this country is fragmenting in many ways, but no clear answer to that question of how does this end and what is our end objective in Iraq. I don't know that we're much clearer and closer to towards that goal.
Well, given that we may not be much closer to the goal that was set forth 5 years ago, and some of the resolution that you've described, Brian, you described as being on the margin, but the one thing that's not on the margins is the amount of money that this country is pouring into the war. Next week, Congress is going to start to consider President Bush's request for another $108 billion in funding for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And if that's granted, that will bring the total for Iraq funding to almost $750 billion that we've put into this. First, I'd like you to listen to this clip from Senator Levin, and then I'd like you to tell me how you think Congress will respond to the president's request.
The Iraqi government seems content to sit by, build up surpluses, and let Americans reconstruct their country, and Americans foot the bill.
Mike, how do you think Congress will respond to that?
Well, Congress is in a tough place because, on the one hand, Congress, I think, is very right in saying this war has not been well prosecuted over time. And obviously, a lot of people think it should never have been waged in the first place and that it was badly handled for 4 years. And so whatever progress we've seen over the last year comes in the context of a very troubling and unsettled situation. On the other hand, you have seen a lot of progress over the last year. And, of course, Congress tends to have in some ways, a secondary role in foreign policy. It doesn't ever want to give up its role, and it should be willing in extreme circumstances to take drastic action even on matters of war and peace. But it's in a situation where not only the commander-in-chief, but more importantly, perhaps for most Americans, the generals on the ground seem to have some hope that things may improve. And even if Brian's right that the progress has been politically at the margin so far, we have seen at least a little momentum. And do we want to give up right at this moment? So Congress is in a terrible position because, in broader historical terms, they're right to be very critical of this strategy. But at this particular moment, it would be a little bit counterintuitive to call it quits, especially for a body that's sort of in this secondary role.
Let me see if I understand you. I mean, you're talking about Congress being in a tough position, but we have to ask ourselves the question, are we getting a return on our investment? And taking that a step further, Brian, I'd like you to address this. Are we getting a return on our investment? And can Congress and the public evaluate that appropriately, given the story that the New York Times reported last week, saying that the Pentagon is using scores of retired military officers, some who have contracts with the government, as puppets in terms of providing information to the American people about what's going on in Iraq?
Well, I think the 110th Congress will likely pass this new supplemental, but I think they're going to ask a lot of tough questions. And I think the answer that many people in Congress have to that question, are we getting a return on investments on our investment in Iraq, is no, in part because many people on Capitol Hill are beginning to look at Iraq in the broader context of, is this making America safer? And I think for most Americans, if you look at the polling, they want to see this war in its rearview mirror. And this is a big challenge for people on Capitol Hill because they need to respond to their constituents. And I think despite the gains in terms of declines in violence and maybe a little bit of political progress inside of Iraq, most Americans are saying, is this making us more safe and prosperous? And I think the answer for them is no. But despite that, I think you've got a gridlock in Congress and you're not going to see strong opposition to the supplemental funding.
Well, Brian and Mike, just very quickly, can Americans evaluate this appropriately given what the New York Times told us?
Well, I don't think that article had some important points. It also, in my opinion, painted with too broad of a brush. I mean, the idea that Barry McCaffrey, for example, has been a consistent supporter of this administration is sort of silly, and it almost seemed to imply that. But it was still correct to point out some of these potential conflicts of interest, if nothing else. I think, let me say something you might have expected Brian to say on his side of the debate more than me on mine. I think the American people are entitled to a better answer from the administration than President Bush gave in his April 10th speech about how long his strategy would take. I'm trying to think that through myself. If you believe that the surge has any hopefulness to it, as we wind down from the surge levels, how much longer do we need to stay in Iraq? No one really gave a clear answer to that in April. And I think...
I'm sorry, Mike, but just as we have to wrap up, Brian, can you respond to Mike's question about that?
Well, look, I think the next president will have to clearly respond to this in the next Congress. And I think we've got a big challenge in this country. We in the think tanks talk about the need for a long war, and I'm largely supportive of that in most theaters, but we've not built the political case for that with the American public at a time when the economy is facing some serious challenges here.
Well, Brian and Michael Hanlon, I want to thank you very much for participating today and joining me at the roundtable. You put important issues and important questions on the table for all of us. Thank you.
Pleasure.
And now for this week's The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, in reverse order. Around the country and on the campaign trail, there's a lot of talk about patriotism. And when Congress debates the president's $108 billion war funding request, there will be a lot of talk about supporting the troops. But beyond the rhetoric, what's really happening? The father of one of our soldiers recently put a video on YouTube that's forcing us to see the conditions those returning from war are facing at home.
This is a photo that Jeff took the morning of April 14th. The second floor toilets have overflowed and there is over 3 inches of water on the floor. I don't need to tell you what the brown water around the floor drain is. There are times when sewage water backs up into the sinks in the lower floors of these barracks.
That's unbelievable. And now for the bad. If there's anything we've learned, it's that the Supreme Court is important. And the next president will probably have a chance to appoint new justices to the court. Here's an example of what one of our current justices, Justice Scalia, thinks about torture.
When he's hurting you in order to get information from you,
yeah.
You don't say he's punishing you.
Now, he's also told us that...
I could be charming and combative at the same time.
Justice Scalia, your definition of torture, not so charming. And in the category of the good, I have to give Jenna Bush a bit of credit. She says she's got an open mind when it comes to supporting a presidential candidate. When she was recently asked if she would vote for Senator McCain, she said,
I don't know. But I mean, you know.
Are you open to?
Yeah, of course. I mean, who isn't open to learning about the candidates? But I mean, and I'm sure everybody is like that. But I honestly have been too busy with books to really pay that much attention.
Jenna, please, please pay attention. In fact, all of us, we've got to pay attention. I am thrilled to have Dr. Jean Lambrew on the Progressive Beat. Jean is an associate professor at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas, and she was a senior health policy official in the Clinton administration, which means that she is a veteran of the 1994 healthcare battle. And while that's all very, very impressive, I think you should know that, like me, Jean has an affinity for the University of North Carolina Tar Heels, which is, of course, the most important thing, isn't it, Jean?
That's absolutely right.
Welcome to the Progressive Beat. Jean, this week, Senator McCain started a nationwide tour to talk about health care. What has he said thus far, and what should we expect to hear from him throughout the week?
Well, it's interesting because he is doing 3 speeches this week. One yesterday at a children's hospital, one today on his health plan and what he's going to do to try to improve it, and then tomorrow in Pennsylvania on health information technology, according to his campaign. And for those of us who have been following his plan and what he's been saying about it, we were encouraged that he was doing it because we had not had that much information, and there are many unanswered questions about his plan. So
right,
he'd
been relatively silent about health care.
Yes, he has about a page and a half on his website that describes his plan. He has given a few speeches, but there are so many unanswered questions that we've all been struggling to figure out what would the consequences be of his plan, although I will say we're beginning to learn that with some of his speeches in the last few days.
And we do have some background on him. I mean, we know because of his history in the Senate and in the House how he's voted on health care in the past. And in fact, I think it's rather ironic that he went to a children's hospital yesterday to give a speech given his votes on children's health care.
Yes. You know, last year we had the fight to reauthorize the Children's Health Insurance Program, which has been by far one of the most popular programs that we've created in the last several decades. It covers about 5 million, 6 million uninsured children. He voted against reauthorizing that program and strengthening it, and was one of the few senators who did this. A bipartisan majority, veto-proof majority, voted for this bill in the Senate, and he voted against it.
I know. He voted against Orrin Hatch and Senator Grassley and other, you know, conservative Republicans. But, Gene, in terms of today's speech, what did Senator McCain tell us? What kind of, you know, how is the picture shaping up in terms of what he would do for the country around health care?
Sure. And I'll just start by saying what we know already. I mean, what we do know already is that he does have a health plan, if not just a status quo plan, and it is actually more radical than any of the Democratic plans, in fact, even many of the bipartisan plans that are out there.
And what do you mean by more radical?
He would move the 160 million people of employer-sponsored health insurance today into what's called the individual insurance market, where you go out and buy insurance on your own.
So that would mean that me, Melody Barnes, would be armed with what, a tax credit to go out and try and find the best health care possible for myself and for my family.
Yes, and in theory, that's a great idea. We all like choices. The problem is he would allow insurers to pick the state where they want to kind of adopt the rules. So I'm living now in Texas, and the health insurance rules here in Texas are, as they say, insurer-friendly, which means that you can be denied coverage, charged a lot more if you're older or have some sort of health risk, and have carve-outs. If you had some sort of lung problem, you can have no coverage of respiratory diseases. So it's good in theory to have these choices, but in reality, any person with some sort of slight health risk may have no choices in this individual market.
And how does his plan differ from what President Bush has said in the past?
The only real difference is that President Bush last year said, let's get rid of the employer-based system, give everybody a tax deduction, and have them go shop in this individual market. Senator McCain would actually give them a tax credit. And he also today announced a new policy to try to address what I think have been effective criticisms about what would happen to people with what are called pre-existing conditions that make them, you know, uninsurable in this market.
And when you say pre-existing conditions, what kinds of diseases, what kinds of conditions are you talking about? Who are we talking about here?
Well, if we there's two types of pre-existing conditions. One is for people who actually have had some illness. And we do know, and we put out a new analysis today at Center for American Progress, that 56 million adults with employer-based insurance today have at least one chronic illness, and that includes, you know, about 18 million people with arthritis, you know, 6 million people with diabetes, 5 million people with cancer.
Well, that's a lot of people, and diseases that are not uncommon. We're not talking about some exotic tropical disease you may have picked up somewhere along the way.
Well, and let me talk about the other type of pre-existing condition problem, things like hay fever, or, you know, smaller kind of asthma types of diseases, which are not as severe but are equally significant, that people have been denied coverage or charged a lot more just because they had those conditions.
Well, first I want to let people know we are talking to Dr. Jean Lambrew. She's a professor at the University of Texas, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund, and you're listening to her on the Progressive Beat. Gene, Senator McCain and Elizabeth Edwards recently have had an interesting exchange regarding his health care plan. He said that she doesn't understand it, and she has said the following.
Basically, John McCain's health care program works very well if you happen to be rich and healthy, and not very well if those are not descriptions of you.
Why such low marks from Elizabeth Edwards with regard to the senator's health care plan?
Because there is just no doubt that a person with a disease like breast cancer or melanoma who needs to get insurance, goes out into this individual market, under very selected conditions they can get access, but they may not be able to afford it. So we know that this market doesn't work for people today. What Senator McCain is proposing today is what he calls the Guaranteed Access Plan, or GAP, which is a high-risk pool. Now, we have seen in 30 or so states high-risk pools that fund the coverage for people who have some sort of pre-existing condition. The problem is that there are typically high premiums, high deductibles, and waiting lists to get into these high-risk pools.
So
they only cover about 200,000 people in America today.
So while Senator McCain is claiming that he's going to come up with a plan that gives more Americans more choice and access to health care, the reality is that his plan will deny more Americans access to health care.
You will lose your option of having employer-based coverage, and if you have a pre-existing condition, you won't even have the choice of individual market coverage. He would move you into one of these high-risk pools where you have no choice.
And again, like you were saying, we're talking about having hay fever or asthma or something like that. But Jean, I have a question for you. The rest of the week, Senator McCain will be giving more speeches about health care. And in fact, going forward, he'll be talking about it. If you could just tell us one or two things that we should be listening to and thinking that we should be thinking about when we listen to Senator McCain talk about his health care plan.
There are two fundamental problems in our health system, and this is what we need to ask him about. How will he address the affordability and cost crisis?
Right, and what's the second one?
The second one is how do we help the 47 million people who lack health insurance today, who are already forced out of the system?
Well,
the affordability crisis is forcing more people out, but we already have a significant problem.
Well, Jean, I hope that those listening to the show will pay attention to those questions. Thank you for being on the Progressive Beat.
Thank you for having me, and congratulations on this show.
Thank you. Everyone is curious what their neighbor or coworker is thinking about this election. Which candidate do you support? What issues matter to you the most? Today, Paige Gardner, the founder of Women's Voices, Women Vote, and one of the country's top political strategists, has joined us to talk about unmarried women who are the potential power brokers in the 2008 election. Welcome, Paige.
Thank you for having me.
So, Paige, this week we have heard a lot about all three presidential candidates doing a taped message for the World Wrestling Entertainment audience, which is 18 to 34-year-old men. And in the past, we've heard about soccer moms and NASCAR dads. Can unmarried women really be power brokers in this election?
Absolutely. Unmarried women, women who are single, separated, divorced, and widow, will actually decide who is and who is not in the White House. Literally, the key to the White House and the road to the White House is paved with the votes of unmarried women.
But Paige, why not all women? Why are you saying and specifically focusing on unmarried women?
There's an enormous difference between married and unmarried women in this country. And marital status...
Well, that's for sure.
Yeah, right? That is true.
As an unmarried woman...
But in so many ways that you wouldn't imagine.
What are you telling us?
Marital status determines whether you will vote and how you will vote. And unmarried women are the largest single progressive voice we have in this country. They're growing at twice the rate of married women, and they are now equal in number to married women. So this is a huge and growing bloc, and they want progressive change in this country.
But have they been turning out in the past? Have they been going to the polls in past elections?
You know, that's interesting, because in the past, they have not registered and not turned out like their married sisters. However, what we are seeing now in the primary election is that gap is closing, and they are turning out in historic numbers and making the difference in the primary elections as well.
Well, before we go on, I do have to ask you this, because I know talking to some of my colleagues here, married and unmarried, that the term unmarried woman, the use of the word unmarried versus single, kind of is a burr under their saddle. It bothers them a little bit. Why that piece of terminology?
You know, what we actually say is women on their own. Because that is the key factor. These women know they are making it, and they know they are making it on their own. So actually, when we speak about quote-unquote unmarried women, what we really are talking about is women on their own.
And are there differences based on race and ethnicity? Are African-American unmarried women likely to focus on issues differently than Latina unmarried women?
You'd be surprised. The differences among unmarried women are very, very small. They're a little bit more racially diverse. They are a little younger and a little older. But in terms of their issues, there is enormous homogeneity among their issue concerns.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the issues. But to start, I'd like for us to listen to a clip from one of your messages to unmarried women.
We could create a national phenomenon by voting, and that's how we protect our national security. Register and vote.
Voting is one of the best things a woman can do.
That's an extraordinary clip. I love the music in the background. I think that's Barbara Streisand. But the thing that struck me about that, national security, is that an issue that really appeals to unmarried women? Is that an issue that's going to drive them to the polls?
Actually, the issue that is driving them and will drive them to the poll is the economy.
Mm.
The economy dominates every single aspect of their lives. Health care, gas prices going up, food prices going up, housing going up. They are stretched economically. And when you look at their salaries, and if you look at their pay equity scale, they're making 56 cents to the dollar.
Which means they must have been really frustrated last week when the Senate tried but was unsuccessful in trying to move a bill that would help women who are not being paid fairly as compared to their male counterparts.
That's exactly right. What we hear from these women is that they want to change who governs America so they can change how America is governed.
Well, Paige, that is a terrific message. Thank you so much for being on the Progressive Beat with Melody Barnes, and we look forward to seeing what unmarried women will do in November. Thank you, Paige.
Thank you.
The next 7 days promise to be very interesting. The march through the primaries continues for the Democrats, onward to North Carolina and Indiana. How will the votes of African Americans, Latinos, Asian Americans, and other people of color affect the results? And have the issues of race and ethnicity become just too politicized? Congress will debate war funding, torture, and troop deployment. How will Clinton, Obama, and McCain vote on those issues? Next week, we'll look at how those hot topics and others are affecting voters going to the polls. Come back and join me on the Progressive Beat with Melody Barnes, broadcast from the Center for American Progress Action Fund.